Okay, so everybody can hear me?
Yes.
Yeah? All right, good. All right, so today's talk is on... Oh, it's on? Yep, let's see. Red light, recording. All right, so today's talk is on hypo and hypernatremia and disorders of water balance. So water balance, as you guys all know, it constitutes approximately 55 to 60% of the human body, total body weight. It's divided into intracellular, which is the biggest compartment, two-thirds. Extracellular is one-third, out of which plasma is one-fourth, and interstitial fluid is three-fourths. So water balance is extremely important, and it's relatively simple. What goes in, what's inside, and what comes out, basically. And what's responsible for really controlling how much water comes out is, to the main extent, it's the kidney and antidiuretic hormone. So we're just going to review the physiology briefly. So this is basically, we're going to go through the concentration of urine. So it's very important to maintain the medullary concentration gradient. And this is the renal tubule. As you can see, this is loop of Henle. And as urine goes down, there is some free water absorption here, but mostly the ascending loop is impermeable to water, which is where you reabsorb your sodium chloride, as well as there's some urea recycling, which makes up the medullary concentration gradient. And as urine flows down the distal collecting tubule and the medullary collecting tubule, this is where the action of ADH occurs, and water is absorbed at this point, and it's facilitated by the concentration gradient in the medullary interstitium. So you need both these things. You need to be able to have the medullary concentration gradient as well as the antidiuretic hormone to absorb your free water. Again, another schematic just to show you a comparison of antidiuresis and water diuresis. So this is the urine osmolality coming down the tubule. As you can see, it's sort of isosmolar at this point to your plasma. And as it comes down, the most concentrated urine is in the tip of the loop of Henle. And again, as the urine goes up, this is where sodium chloride is reabsorbed, and urine becomes more dilute. And at this point, in the distal collecting tubule and in the cortical collecting, the medullary collecting tubule, is where the action of ADH occurs. And in the presence of antidiuretic hormone, you reabsorb your water, and urine becomes more concentrated. And the maximum concentration of urine will be 1,200 milliosmoles per kilo. As opposed to water diuresis when ADH is absent, again, you can see it's very similar, the urine osmolality, until you get to the collecting tubule. And when ADH is absent, you actually don't reabsorb the water. And over here, some of the sodium chloride is also reabsorbed, and the urine becomes more and more dilute. And you can have maximal urine dilution at 50 milliosmoles per kilo. So ADH has a large impact on how much water you're excreting. So plasma osmolality in healthy adults is maintained in a very narrow range. It's between 275 and 290 milliosmoles per kilo. And the stimulus for arginine vasopressin are two. There's the serum osmolality and the effective circulating volume. So whenever you have increase in your serum osmolality or decrease in your effective circulatory volume, two things occur. Number one, there's increased thirst, and you increase your water intake. And number two is increased antidiuretic hormone release, which then causes decreased water excretion. You have water retention, and basically you bring you have decreased plasma osmolality, and you increase your circulatory volume. And again, it goes back to decreased thirst and decreased ADH secretion. So as far as the stimulus for ADH secretion, plasma osmolality, after your osmolality goes above 280, there's increased stimulation. As you can see, this is plasma ADH in picograms per ml. And there's a linear increase in ADH secretion. And in terms of hypovolemia or the circulatory volume, once you lose more than 5% of your effective circulatory volume, again, ADH goes up. As you can see, the units are a lot higher. So your effective circulatory volume is actually a more stronger stimulus for ADH secretion than even your serum osmolality. Again, arginine vasopressin is produced in the supraoptic nucleus and the paraventricular nucleus, and it's stored in the posterior pituitary gland. And whenever you have osmotic stimulus or non-osmotic stimuli, which is the decrease in effective circulatory volume, ADH is secreted. It comes and acts on the distal collecting tubule and the medullary collecting tubule and increases the free water reabsorption. So there are two major receptors for arginine vasopressin, the V1, which is also divided into V1A and B, and V2 receptors. The activation of V1 induces vasoconstriction and enhancement of prostaglandin release, and activation of V2 mediates the antidiuretic response. Another thing that the V1 receptor does is increases the von Willebrand factor and factor 8, which is when you see patients who have renal failure on dialysis, they're bleeding, and you'll probably see the renal fellow recommending that you go ahead and give DDAVP, and that's where the DDAVP acts. So vasopressin binds to the V2 receptor. So basically, it's been secreted by the posterior pituitary. It's in your blood. Collecting tubular cell. This is the lumen where the urine is, and this would be where the blood is passing through. So vasopressin binds to the V2 receptor and activates the adenylate cyclase, which turns to CMP and PKA, which basically phosphorylates your AQUA2 receptor, which is the aquaporin that is actually stimulated by the arginine vasopressin. And this vesicle goes to the lumen where the urine is flowing, reabsorbs the water, and then the water basically gets reabsorbed into the blood by the aquaporin 4 and 3, which are not under the effect of ADH. So this is basically where the aquaporins act. When you saw the loop of Henle, there was some free water absorption. Again, that's aquaporin 1, 2, 3, and 4. So basically it's the aquaporin 2. That's affected by the ADH, that the ADH acts on. So hyponatremia is the most common electrolyte disorder in hospitalized patients. There was a study in nephrology dialysis transplant in 2006, which looked at almost 3,000 patients over 3 months. And the incidence of hyponatremia was about 30%, with severe hyponatremia being about 3%. So it's pretty common. You'll see it quite frequently during your residency. It's generally defined as serum sodium less than 136 milliosmoles per liter, though the definition can vary in different literature, 110 to 125. It's particularly prevalent in the elderly population, and it's due to age-related decline in renal function. Thirst mechanism diminishes with age, which increases the risk of volume depletion, the decreased ability to dilute your urine, and increased secretion of vasopressin per unit increase in plasma osmolality. As your renal function declines, you're not able to secrete your free water as effectively as you would if you had normal renal function. So therefore, you dilute down your serum and have hyponatremia. There was also a study of about 119 nursing home residents over the age of 60, and 53% of these residents had at least one episode of hyponatremia during a 12-month follow-up. So again, it's fairly common in the elderly. Hyponatremia is characterized by an excess of extracellular water relative to the extracellular sodium. And therefore, it's mainly a problem of water balance. And that's actually the critical thing. In both hypo and hypernatremia, it's mainly a problem of the water balance. Though the total sodium concentration may be normal, decreased, or even increased, it's really the water balance that determines your serum sodium. And excretion and absorption of free water by the kidneys is under the control of ADH like we just saw in the previous slides. So what do you need for evaluation of hyponatremia when you have somebody admitted on the floor? You need their serum osmolality, urine osmolality, and a spot urine or a random urine sodium. Other helpful labs will be uric acid, which is usually low in SIDH, and also in salt-wasting nephropathy, TSH, cortisol, and creatinine. So again, hyponatremia is divided into elevated serum osmolality, normal serum osmolality, or decreased serum osmolality. With elevated serum osmolality, usually hyperglycemia, or occasionally you may see mannitol infusion. The most of the time when you come across this in the hospital, it's with hyperglycemia. Normal serum osmolality, again, this is something you may see rarely. Somebody who's admitted with multiple myeloma and their serum sodium is low, when you actually send their serum osmolality to the lab, it comes back normal. And decreased serum osmolality, which has a much wider differential. So pseudohyponatremia is not the hyponatremia that you get with hyperglycemia. That is real, because a lot of times I see interns and residents labeling that as pseudohyponatremia. In hyperglycemia, you have free water coming out of the cells, diluting down your serum sodium. Pseudohyponatremia is basically when your lipid or protein level increases because of either multiple myeloma, globulins, triglyceridemia, and your plasma water, which is where they're measuring the serum sodium, decreases, but they're measuring it in the total volume, and therefore they get a low sodium level. And this is something you can actually call to the lab, and they'll correct it for you. If you let them know you have a patient who has a very high protein level, you're suspecting multiple myeloma, they will recalibrate the lab value for you. Again, this is something that's a schematic of the algorithm of diagnosing etiology of hyponatremia. You have to assess the volume status, hypovolemia, euvolemia, or hypervolemia, and measure their serum sodium, and accordingly come up with a differential for the etiology of the hyponatremia. So in terms of hypovolemia, renal losses, especially due to diuretic excess, mineral corticoid deficiency, like adrenal insufficiency, salt-losing nephropathy, bicarbonuria, osmotic diuresis, cerebral salt wasting. In terms of if your serum sodium is less than 20, it's usually extra-renal losses, vomiting, diarrhea, or third spacing. In hypervolemia, again, if it's greater than 20, the urine sodium is most likely due to renal failure because, again, your kidney is not able to reabsorb the sodium like a normal kidney can. And if it's less than 20, it's usually due to nephrotic syndrome, heart failure, or cirrhosis. So just going in a little bit more detail, hypovolemia associated with decreased body sodium. So if you have GI losses or third space sequestered losses, urine sodium will usually be low, less than 10 millimoles per liter, and urine will be hypoosmolar. In patients who have vomiting or metabolic alkalosis, they will tend to dump their bicarb in the urine, and that's usually dumped as sodium bicarb. So you will see a urine sodium that's actually greater than 20, but the urine chloride will still be less than 10, so that will be a clue. If there's a discrepancy between the sodium and the chloride in the random urine electrolytes. Diuretics, of course, you're going to see an elevated urine sodium because that's what diuretics do. They dump salt and water follows. And hyponatremia occurs almost exclusively with the use of thiazide diuretics and not with loop diuretics. And the reason for that is that loop diuretics actually dilute down your medullary concentration gradient. So the effect of ADH is not as prominent with loop diuretics, whereas thiazide diuretics do not have that effect. Again, underweight women, elderly patients are more prone to this. And with thiazide diuretics, you usually see the hyponatremia within 1 to 2 weeks. So if you have somebody elderly in the clinic who you're starting on thiazide diuretics, it's a good idea to recheck their chemistry in a couple of weeks just to make sure they're not becoming hyponatremic. Salt losing nephropathy, this can occur with advanced CKD. Again, your tubules are not able to reabsorb the sodium the way they should. Also, in disorders such as Bartter's and Gittleman's, which end up losing sodium chloride in the urine, they act like diuretics, basically. Their syndrome is very similar to somebody who's on a diuretic. Mineral corticoid deficiency, your urine sodium will be elevated. And again, the decreased extracellular volume, once you're dumping your sodium, is a stimulus for vasopressin release. Osmotic diuresis. This is a big one. You usually see diabetic patients who have severe hyperglycemia. Mannitol diuresis, we really don't see very much anymore. It's not something that's used a lot. Or urea diuresis after relief of urinary tract infection, or even a diuretic phase of ATN. You end up dumping your urea and you get an osmotic diuresis. And typically, again, your sodium is greater than 20. And the sodium wasting in diabetics is accentuated by the ketone urea. Cerebral salt wasting, it can occur with, again, something that's very uncommon, you don't see very frequently. And it's thought to be due to the release of the brain natriuretic peptide, with the resultant increase in sodium excretion and hypovolemia. Hypervolemia associated with increased total body sodium. Congestive heart failure, your urine sodium will be less than 20. Again, your kidney is seeing a decreased effective volume in terms of renal blood flow and tends to hold on to its sodium. Hepatic failure, basically, it has the same pathophysiological mechanism as heart failure in terms of the kidney's response. Nephrotic syndrome, these patients can be intravascular depleted because of hypoalbuminuria and fluid going on into the interstitial space with resultant increase in ADH secretion as well. And advanced CKD, in which your fractional excretion of sodium is increased because, again, you're dumping your salt and you're not able to get rid of your free water as effectively as a kidney that's functioning normally. And hyponatremia associated with normal total body sodium, usually glucocorticoid deficiency, that's a renal insufficiency, hypothyroidism, psychosis, post-op hyponatremia. This is usually because they get a lot of hypotonic fluids and the surgery itself is a stimulus for antidiuretic hormones secretion, and therefore they hold on to their free water and it results in hyponatremia. Drugs and syndrome of inappropriate antidiuresis. So the syndrome of inappropriate antidiuresis is a newer terminology because not all patients have elevated arginine vasopressin, as opposed to syndrome of inappropriate ADH secretion. So there's SIADH, in which you do have the secretion of arginine vasopressin is independent of the serum osmolality. Reset osmostat, in which the arginine vasopressin does not become fully suppressed until it's at a specific serum osmolality, and then the kidney does end up dumping the free water. But up till a sodium of 127, it'll hang on to the free water. And once your serum osmolality reaches a certain set point, the kidney actually starts to dump out the free water. And mutations in the water channel regulating vasopressin receptor, which results in a concentrated urine in the absence of AVP. So it's really a mutation in the receptors that may be causing this problem. So the diagnostic criteria for syndrome of inappropriate diuresis is serum osmolality less than 275 milliosmoles per kilo, urine osmolality greater than 100, clinical euvolemia, serum sodium of greater than 40, but again, this depends on their input of salt. If they're taking in less salt, they're going to be putting out less salt. So if somebody is not eating too well, you may not see that urine sodium of greater than 40 milliosmoles per liter. Normal thyroid, adrenal, and renal function, and no recent use of diuretics. Other features you may see is plasma uric acid less than 4, a BUN less than 10, fractional excretion greater than 1%, or fractional excretion of urea greater than 55. basically, if it's less than 1% or less than 35, that's more of a pre-renal state. Failure to correct the hyponatremia after normal saline. Because if your sodium does correct after just giving normal saline, it was most likely related to hypovolemia and not SIAD. Of course, there are many medications that can cause hyponatremia. This is just some of them. Among the important ones, DDAVP, if it's given in large doses, can cause hyponatremia. We actually had a patient who had come in who had surgery for a nasal polyp, who had a coagulation disorder and had received DDAVP prior to the surgery and had come in with seizures and a very low sodium. So if it's given even for prophylactic purposes prior to surgery, it's something that you could see. Other important drugs, ifosfamide, chemotherapy is something you see. Cyclophosphamide also can cause SIADH. And a lot of the antipsychotic medications or antidepressants can also cause SIADH-like picture. So hyponatremia that's not related to increased antidiuretic hormone secretion. Because as you saw, the main the main control of water reabsorption or excretion is really the ADH. The medullary concentration gradient does make a difference, but the antidiuretic hormone is in all the different disorders, whether you're hypervolemic, hypovolemic, or euvolemic, it's the main culprit behind retaining most of your free water and diluting down your serum sodium. So disorders that are not related to ADH, if your initial urine osmolality is less than 100, it could be psychogenic polydipsia or beer potomania. And beer potomania is just severe decrease of solute intake. It's usually alcoholics who come in, with hyponatremia, and they've been just taking in beer, which is mostly carbohydrates, and doesn't really have a lot of solute intake. And they're not able to excrete their free water because you need a certain amount of solute to carry the water out with it. So those are the two things with if you have a urine osmolality less than 100. If your initial urine osmolality is greater than 100, it could be a reset osmostat, like we discussed before, or a mutation in the AVP receptor. And salt losing nephropathy, because you're actually losing a lot of salt, which is one of the main reasons why you're hyponatremic, though also it does, this is not totally true, it does also increase ADH secretion because you're hypovolemic with losing so much salt, sodium. So how does the low dietary salt in solute intake work in cases of beer protomania? And it's not only seen in alcoholics who come in, it's also seen in elderly females who may just be having like a tea and toast type of diet, which you've probably seen a lot in your board questions. Again, they're having just bread, which is mostly carbohydrates, and they're drinking tea, which is mostly water. So they're not getting a lot of solute intake, which would pretty much come from salt and protein intake. So most people take in and excrete about 600 to 1,000 milliosmoles per kilo. And again, the urine osmoles are mostly salt and urea because the glucose gets metabolized. So a person who's taking in and excreting 600 milliosmoles, if you dilute your urine down to 60 milliosmoles per kilo, you can excrete up to 10 liters a day. So the amount of osmoles you're taking in really does determine how much urine you can make. You can't make too much urine if you're not taking in a certain amount of osmoles. Because as you know, you can only go down to 50 or 60 milliosmoles per kilo if you dilute your urine maximally. So if someone only takes in about 240 milliosmoles per kilo, then at the lowest urine osmolality, they can only excrete about 4 liters of urine. And therefore, if that person drinks any more than 4 liters, the rest is all water. It dilutes down your serum sodium and causes hyponatremia. So that's the pathogenesis behind hyponatremia caused by beer potomania or elderly ladies who just take a tea and toast diet. Again, in their urine osmolality, you're going to see a urine osmolality less than 100 because they're not taking in much solute. So psychogenic polydipsia, the same concept applies. If a person's taking in 600 milliosmoles per kilo at a maximal urine dilution, which is 60 milliosmoles, they can only get rid of about 10 liters of water. And if they drink more than that, they'll retain the water and again dilute down their serum sodium and have hyponatremia. So range of symptoms. There is a wide range of symptoms for hyponatremia. Confusion, headache, nausea, vomiting, muscle cramps, and of course the severe neurological complications that you always have to be on the lookout for because the treatment is different. Seizures, brainstem herniation from cerebral edema, coma, and death. So how does the brain adapt to hyponatremia? Osmotic cerebral edema that occurs with plasma hypoosmolality and hyponatremia affects both the intracellular and extracellular compartments of the gray and white matter. Cerebral edema is counteracted by adaptive response known as regulatory volume decrease that normalizes the cell volume. So this is very important. The stimulus for the brain cell is you're hyponatremic, the environment outside the cell is hypoosmolar, the water is just going to flood inside the cell. So basically how this works is there's initially a displacement of fluid from the interstitial to the cerebral spinal fluid and then systemic circulation. And this is, of course, driven by the hydrostatic pressure. Then there's the extrusion of the brain cells of inorganic, osmotically active solutes, including sodium chloride and potassium. The sodium chloride goes first within minutes, and then potassium is a little bit more gradual over 3 hours. And then exclusion of organic osmolytes, primarily amino acids, such as myo-inositol. It's the most prevalent organic osmolyte, and that occurs over the next 48 hours. And in animal studies, they've seen that if this adaptive response was not taking place, this would not be compatible with life. Now, this is the same reason why some people who have hypokalemia or who are malnourished or alcoholics are more at risk for pontine demyelination, because whatever is occurring to adapt to the hyponatremia has to go right back in once your sodium is corrected. And if they're hypokalemic or malnourished, this readaptive response is also very slow and doesn't occur. So one of the things you have to do if somebody is hyponatremic and hypokalemic is to correct their potassium, because you can see how important that is in adapting to hypernatremia and also adapting to the response to treatment. So acute hyponatremia is defined as occurs over less than 24 hours, and this can overwhelm this protective mechanism. And if it's slow, greater than 40 hours, 48 hours, then the cerebral symptoms are minimized. So correction of hyponatremia. The plasma sodium concentration can be raised by, basically, again, it's water in, water out. Restricting water intake by giving salt and by giving a vasopressin receptor antagonist, which is... there's actually one right now out on the market in terms of IV. It's not something that we use very commonly. It is available at Jacobi if you ask the pharmacist for it. In fact, we had a study that we had going on, which is now finished. And again, the choice of therapy is governed by the severity of the symptoms and the hyponatremia. So in case, this is something, again, you guys all know, in case of symptomatic acute hyponatremia, you correct by 1.5 to 2 milliequivalents per liter in the first 4 hours. And then in the over the 24 hours, you shouldn't go more than 10 to 12 milliequivalents over the 24 hours. In asymptomatic chronic hyponatremia, you want to correct slower at 0.5 milliequivalents per hour. And again, not more than 10 to 12 over 24 hours. So how do you calculate how much 3% to give if somebody comes into the ER with acute hyponatremia with neurological symptoms? So in this example, it's a 70-kilogram patient who has a serum sodium of 110. So you calculate the sodium deficit, which is the total body water multiplied by 120 minus 110. 120 is basically once you're over the threshold of 120, you're more in the relatively safe range. So you want to definitely try and get up to take that as your mark where you want to get up to. And you correct the rate at 1.5 milliequivalents an hour, you would be required to give about 420 milliequivalents over 6.5 hours. So about 64 milliequivalents an hour. 3% has about 513 milliequivalents per liter of sodium. Therefore, it's roughly 2 cc's of 3% has 1 milliequivalent of sodium. So it's sort of easier to calculate that way. And you'll have to give about 128 cc's an hour. So you want to do that for the first 4 hours. And then you want to slow down the rate of collection because you don't want to go over 10 to 12 milliequivalents over 24 hours. Now, this is very difficult to do in the emergency room. And when it's done in the ICU, you'll probably have the renal fellow hounding you for the serum sodiums because you definitely don't want to overcorrect. And a lot of the patients who come in are malnourished. They are alcoholics. They're elderly women on thiazide diuretics, and they're at very high risk for pontine demyelination. So it's something we really have to take seriously when you're doing this. And in the ER, it's almost impossible to really get those serum sodiums on time. So you really want to get these patients into the unit quickly. So why not just use normal saline to correct serum sodium and SIADH? Because this is something that I've also seen residents and interns do. If you're calculating the sodium deficit, why do you need to use 3%? Why not just use normal saline and calculate out how many milliequivalents of sodium you're going to get? So basically, to illustrate this is another example. So again, you have a patient who has a urine osmolality of 600 milliequivalents per kilo, and we give normal saline, which has totally approximately 300 milliosmoles between the sodium and chloride. And your sodium excretion is intact in SIADH. So you're able to get rid of your salt. You just can't get rid of your water effectively. So then basically the 300 milliosmoles will be excreted in 500 cc's of normal saline because your osmolality is 600 in the urine. This leaves behind about half a liter of free water, and therefore it will worsen your underlying hyponatremia. And again, this is one of the things you may see in the ER. Patient comes in with hyponatremia. They start the patient on normal saline, and the serum sodium improves. Most likely that patient was hypovolemic, which is one of the criteria to exclude SIADH if they improve with normal saline. So again, in SIADH, you need to have an intake which is more concentrated than the urine. And you know how we do that? We do water restriction, salt tablets, Lasix with salt tablets. But that's the goal, to get an intake which is more concentrated in a urine that's more dilute. So you're getting rid of free water and your sodium is coming, the sodium level is coming up. So in terms of treatment of chronic hyponatremia, again, just restriction of fluid intake. You encourage dietary intake of salt and protein. Again, that's the solute that helps to increase your urine output and get rid of some of the free water. Demacocycline, this is a tetracycline antibiotic derivative. It actually antagonizes the AVP receptor. It does have some toxicities. It's really not used anymore unless we absolutely have to in the outpatient clinic. I haven't used it for years, actually. So it has some neurotoxicity, and it's mostly excreted by the liver. So any patients you have with liver disease, it's definitely not a good drug for. And a vasopressin antagonist when it's available more commonly orally, which is not the case at this point. So again, treatment of chronic hyponatremia, just going through fluid restriction. How much fluid to restrict? It's actually quite variable. It depends how hyponatremic the patient is. If it's an outpatient clinic patient and the sodium is not very low, you could start with 1,500, 1,200 cc's and work your way down in terms of fluid depending on what their sodium level is. Lithium, which inhibits kidney response to vasopressin, as we know it can actually cause a DI, but this is not something I've used for hyponatremia because lithium has its own issues in terms of it has a very narrow range of therapeutic you can get lithium toxicity. Demacocycline, we talked about, and the V2 receptor antagonists. The other things that we usually do, we can put the patient on salt tablets with some furosemide. Furosemide increases your water restriction, water excretion as compared to the salt excretion. So it's actually a more dilute urine. So if you give salt tablets and then have them produce a more dilute urine with Lasix, it also helps the serum sodium. Urea, again, have never used, never tried. Apparently it's very unpalatable. But same, it causes osmotic diuresis, which again is a way to get rid of your as much free water as you can. Though in your urine, you can never just get rid of pure water. You're just trying to get that urine as dilute as you possibly can. So the Vaptans, arginine vasopressin receptor antagonist, Conivaptan IV is in the market. At this time, it has a half-life of about 8 to 10 hours. It's usually given as a small bolus and an infusion. And the main side effect is really thirst. And at this point, it is FDA approved for euvolemic hyponatremic patients in the hospital. There are oral agents that are, I don't believe they're right now out on the market, but they're very close to it. But this is something that will be very helpful, especially in our outpatient clinic patients with SIDH. So osmotic demyelination syndrome, it's again overly rapid correction of the serum sodium. And it results in dehydration of the neurons, as opposed to when you first had hyponatremia, you have cerebral edema. When you overcorrect, you get dehydration because the water just flows out, and which leads to the osmotic demyelination syndrome. So the correction of the hyponatremia causes the efflux of water from the brain, triggering a de-adaptation response. So the inorganic and organic osmolytes, which were lost during the regulatory volume decrease, re-enter the brain and re-establish osmotic equilibrium. And again, in hypokalemic patients or malnourished and alcoholics, this response is blunted. So again, the reuptake is slower than the initial loss that occurred as a response to the hyponatremia. And we already went over people who are at increased risk. So the osmotic demyelination syndrome includes both central pontine and extrapontine myelinosis. It begins with lethargy, affective changes, mutism, dysarthria, spastic quadriparesis, and pseudobulbar palsy. And you may not see this. You may see this a week after the patient was admitted and the sodium was corrected and they were discharged. So it's not something you may see right away. And you may have patients who may come back for readmission with neurological symptoms after their sodium has been corrected too rapidly. Again, I think this is something we've pretty much gone through, people who are higher risk for neurological complications. So hypernatremia, it's, again, a disorder of your water. You have decreased water supply, either poor access to water, such as our nursing home patients who come in with sepsis, lethargy, just are not taking in any free water and they're hypernatremic. You can also have hypothalamic lesions with tumors, infections, sarcoid, which affect your thirst response, and you don't drink as much water and again become hypernatremic. Water loss, again, you have three main avenues for water loss: renal, GI, and insensible losses. In case of renal osmotic diuresis, such as hyperglycemia, again, if you have diuretic phase of ATN, post-obstruction, you're losing your urea and the water is flowing out with it. Central or nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. GI osmotic diarrhea, usually this is a large colon because at that point you have more water secretion and you're losing a very dilute stool, and therefore you're losing a lot more water than sodium or potassium. And insensible losses such as high fevers, exercise, or exposure to very high temperatures. And a solute load, and this is again something we see in the ICU. Somebody comes in very acidotic and receives large boluses of sodium bicarb for the acidosis. You may see them get hypernatremic just from the increased sodium. So I guess working up hypernatremia, if you go into that sequence of water going in and water coming out, or getting too much, your first question is the patient not drinking? Is the patient not getting enough free water? Also, in the case of ICU patients, this is something we see quite frequently. They're really not getting any free water, NG feeds, and they become hypernatremic, and they may be volume depleted. Is there increased free water loss? Is there polyuria? So differential of polyuria, there are basically three things that can cause polyuria, which is urine more than 3 liters over 24 hours. There's osmotic diuresis or solute diuresis, diabetes insipidus, and psychogenic polydipsia. In the case of psychogenic polydipsia, you're not going to see hypernatremia. So you're basically down to diabetes insipidus or osmotic diuresis. And the urine osmolality is very helpful in that. If it's 250 or less, it's usually a DI, as opposed to greater than 300, it would be more of a solute diuresis. And again, this is something we see in our unit patients who are getting a lot of saline. They're recovering from their ATN. They're just putting out tons of urine. And they're having a solute diuresis, or they're getting TPN with a lot of protein in the TPN. Again, that urea is going to cause osmotic diuresis. Or GI, which is if they're having a lot of diarrhea. And then the last question you want to ask is, are they getting too much solute? Again, the most common thing we see is bicarb or in terms of hypertonic solutions with sodium. So treatment of hypernatremia, you want to give them free water. So the first thing you want to do is calculate the free water deficit, which is 0.5. Basically, usually your total body water is 0.6, but when they're in a volume depleted state, it's for men it's usually 0.5, and for women 0.4 times your body weight with plasma sodium, or 140 minus 1. And the rate of correction, again, should be 0.5 milliequivalents per hour. So just as an example of treatment of hypernatremia, you have a 60-year-old female with ARDS on a ventilator support on pressors and TPN. She's hemodynamically stable. Plasma sodium is 150. Urine output is about 150 mLs per hour, which comes out to over 3 liters in 24 hours. Urine osmolality is 504. Urine sodium is 40. So you know she's polyuric, so she's definitely losing it in the urine. And you know the urine osmolality is high, so this is a solute or osmotic diuresis. Urine dipstick is 2+ for glucose, actually, this is what. And the glucose in the serum is 400. So you have a reason why she's having osmotic diuresis. So the cause would be osmotic diuresis. And how would you treat, should be her? So you calculate the water deficit. And you want to add in the insensible losses, especially for people who are on the ventilator or having high fevers. And if you calculate the free water deficit plus the insensible losses, it comes out to about 2.4 liters. And you want to bring this down at 0.5 milliequivalents an hour, which would take about 20 hours because 150 to 140. Whereas in hyponatremia, you're using 120 as your cutoff. With hyper, you're using about 140. And this would basically come out to about 120 mLs of free water. So free water, the best, if you can give as much of it orally or via NG, that's great. Otherwise, it would be D5W. That would be the free water. If you can't use D5W because the blood sugar is running high and you really don't want to push that up, then you can use other solutions. And actually, depending on which solution you use, you can calculate how much of that solution is needed to correct your sodium slowly. So this is actually from New England Journal of Medicine. I think this is from 2000. So they this works out quite well also. So in case, I think I've seen some of you use these equations to figure out how much fluid to give or free water deficit and give D5, either of those is fine, as long as the rate of correction is controlled and you're monitoring it. Okay, that's it. So are there any questions? Actually, in SIDH with antidiuretic hormone, there is increased secretion of uric acid. Not really sure why. That's one reason. And the other reason is that because you're retaining free water, it does get diluted down as well. So those are the two main reasons. You're putting out more uric acid in the urine, and you're diluting down your serum uric acid value. And it is quite a good test for SIDH. So it's something you should do if you have a patient who comes in with hyponatremia. So basically, if the patient, so what you've told me so far is that urine osmolality is high and the patient's on thiazides. So how thiazides cause hyponatremia, the main mechanism is hypovolemia. So in that case, though there is some effect on ADH secretion directly too, but I think initially you have to go for hypovolemia. You should check the uric acid level. That would be helpful. But you would stop the thiazide diuretics and you would give her some saline and see what happens with the sodium. And that's basically what you would, your initial treatment would be for a thiazide-induced hyponatremia. They are. And in Barters, you don't really so much see hyponatremia as such. You really see a lot of sodium in the urine, but you don't see hyponatremia. You see volume depletion. These patients may have orthostatic hypotension, but you really don't see the hyponatremia. Anything else? Okay.